Each December, that means around this time of year, the Library of Congress selects 25 films to add to the National Film Registry. The list is now up to 500 movies, but what were the criteria for including them, and is this something the non-expert should even care about? Well, Daniel Egan writes about every one of them in America's Film Legacy, a guide to the National Film Registry, which has just been published by Continuum Press, and I'm very pleased it has brought him back to this show. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, why a book about the National Film Registry? Haven't most of these titles already been covered in other books?
Well, you think they would have. Films like Star Wars, which we just heard, and The Wizard of Oz, certainly there have been a lot of books and articles about them. But when I started researching these movies, I found that there was no one book that covered all of them because they are of so many different genres and types. There's no one that does home movies and documentaries and feature films, so I thought that would be interesting to cover them.
Well, what is the National Film Industry?
Registry. Well, it started as a sort of grassroots opposition to colorization and to editing of films back in the 1980s. The film directors like Frank Capra and John Huston, they were just dismayed because they had no control over what was happening to their movies. It's Wonderful Life, for example, was being colorized, The Maltese Falcon. And they actually
Ted Turner really is the inspiration for this whole thing.
I'm not going to say anything against Ted. Ted's a great guy. He's actually helped film a lot. But yes, the colorization was a big problem. The directors actually went to Congress and complained about not only those things, but also about how their films are being altered for videotape and for broadcast. And as a result, there was legislation passed to protect films. And that's the National Film Registry came out of that legislation.
And then they decided to choose 25 films a year. Well, we're at 500. That means they've been doing it for a while now.
Yes, since 1988. The idea of calling attention to the problem of preservation is why they formed the registry and they've selected 25 films each year.
Are they the best films ever made?
Well, some of them are.
We're talking about American films only, aren't we?
Yes, there are American films. Some of them are the best films ever made, but also the National Film Preservation Board, the Library of Congress, the people who select the films are very careful to point out that these are culturally and historically and aesthetically significant films and not necessarily the best films ever made.
So sometimes they just represent something, or they show us something that we might not know about otherwise, even if they're not great aesthetically.
They're symbolic, I guess. But you could say, when you look at the list, you could see that just about every major film figure in America is represented in one way or the other.
Are there any films you might have expected to find on the list that haven't made it yet?
Well, there are films that I like that aren't there yet, but not everyone shares my taste. I think for 500 films, if you wanted an introduction to film, if you wanted to be culturally literate in film, these are the 500 you would have to know something about.
How did you approach the project? Had you seen most of the films before you began working on the book?
No, actually. Well, I would say probably 60%, 70% of them. A lot of the films I'd never heard of before. I'd like to point out, I should say, I'm not really a film expert. I'm an enthusiast. What I found out when I was working on this is that there are a lot of people who know a lot more about film than I do. So what I try to do is approach it as a layman, to approach it like, to explain it in terms of not an expert, not in terms of auteur theory or gender studies or things like that. I wanted to just show why these films are good and why you would like to see them.
But in seeing a whole bunch of films, I'm assuming you watched every film here to prepare for the book.
No, actually, I didn't see.
You didn't see all 500 of them?
Sorry, no. No. There were three that I couldn't see.
Three you couldn't?
Well, yes. And that brings up an important point because what I wanted to make a point about this book is that it's important to see films as films on screen projected in a movie theater, and that's becoming increasingly hard to do. People think that they see a film on television and it's the same thing, but it's not. It affects you differently. It's
even a widescreen HDTV.
Well, it's different. I think it's really different because film is a communal experience. You're sitting in an audience in the dark with people. When you're watching something on TV, you control it. When you're watching a film in a theater, the film controls you. That's what I feel. Anyway, the three films I didn't see, I saw parts of them. One was The Exploits of Elaine. I saw most of that. It's a serial from 1914. One was Empire, the Andy Warhol film, which is a shot of the Empire State Building, which lasts 8 hours. And
so you got the gist of it by watching it for 2 hours or so.
I saw the estate approved cut down version, and it was enough for me. And then finally, the third film I didn't see was This Is Cinerama, which can only be seen in 3 theaters in the world. One's in England, one's in Seattle, and one's in Los Angeles. And I would love to see it, but I couldn't. Mm-hmm. Couldn't see the original Cinerama.
That was a big sensation when it came out. 3 screens. And I still remember the roller coaster ride. It was almost as exciting as being on a real roller coaster.
Well, I envy you. That must have been a tremendous experience. The thing about Cinerama that was great was that they were trying to encompass your entire field of vision. So the screen was enormous, and it was a live experience, too. They were mixing the sound live every performance for that.
Well, you said that it's best to see these in a theater, but that's not always possible, is it? I'm assuming that you saw a fair number of them on some kind of DVD or videotape form.
Well, I tried to see everything on film. I really did. Some of them were not available on film, and some for scheduling reasons I couldn't, but I tried to work through it chronologically and on film. And
well, where can you even see these films?
There are
like
museums.
Old serials, for example.
Museums are very helpful. New York Public Library is very helpful. I went to the Library of Congress in Washington. I went to the National Archives in Washington. One of the deals of the registry is that they're supposed to, once a film is selected, they're supposed to leave a sort of master copy with the Library of Congress, which is supposed to be available to the public. That's not always the case, but the Library of Congress did have a lot of films, which I saw.
Mm-hmm. So you went there and you said to the Library of Congress, I'm writing this book, they let you see it, but if I want to see these movies, am I going to be able to see all of them?
Most of the films are available on DVD if you want to see them that way, or on video, or you can actually see a lot of them on YouTube, which is a ghastly experience, but you can see them there. But yes, the part of the function of the Library of Congress is to make material available to the public. So you can go down there and say, I want to see this film, and they will do it at their convenience, but they will do it.
And you include information on how to gain access to the harder-to-find films in the book?
For every film, yes, I show, I give you the information about how you can see it or obtain it yourself.
Could you tell us about some of the more obscure movies that most people haven't heard about but that you really enjoyed?
Some of the films that I'd never heard about were just really fascinating. There's one called The Forgotten Frontier, which is a documentary made in 1930 by Mary Marvin Breckinridge, an amateur filmmaker who went down there to Kentucky and did this fascinating documentary out on herself on a horse with her 35-millimeter camera, and she did a great job. There's a film series called Towpaths, which I'd never heard of. It's color footage of the Japanese internment camps shot by one of the inmates and smuggled out for processing during World War II, and it's the only color footage we have of the internment camps. There are home movies, one by Robin Sparstow, who lives up in Connecticut. He made a film called Disneyland Dream back in the 50s, the year after Disneyland opened. It's a really wonderful home movie. There are a lot of movies like that that were really great to see.
I'm assuming there are also newsreels that turn out to be a lot more fascinating than we might expect.
The newsreels are very scary. A lot of them you're familiar with, like the Hindenburg disaster. But there was one newsreel, it was also the San Francisco earthquake. That was really devastating footage shot right after the earthquake. There's one newsreel made in 1937, I believe, for the Republic Steel strike. And it shows the Memorial Day massacre, where the police opened fire on the strikers in a field outside the Republic Steel factory. And you can see the wounded. You can see the people being dragged into paddy wagons, being beaten over the head. It was shocking when I saw it.
Mm. Well, I guess this is also a lesson in American history, not just the newsreels, but if you watch them chronologically, as you suggest, you probably get a real sense of how attitudes in this country have changed, how the look of the country has changed.
That was one of the reasons why I tried to do it chronologically. Yes, it is. It shows you how film changed over 100 years, but it also shows you how it sort of remained the same. People were working with sound and color back in the 1890s, for example, on wide screens. But if you go through chronologically, you see...
And was the color any good?
Color was great, and it's still great today. There was hand-stenciled color. There was also a color process, which it was really remarkable on widescreen. But you can see film growing from just one-shot 20-second films to these epic things 4 or 5 hours long. And it's wonderful watching that evolution sort of appear before your eyes.
And the earliest films are these one-shot films? How far back do the films go?
It goes back to 1893 with blacksmithing scene shot out in New Jersey by Edison's studio. It's just one shot, three guys in the studio.
I guess that was a demo.
Actually, it was the first film to be shown to the public. So that's why it's on. But there were a couple earlier films and earlier experiments.
How soon before films start looking like films, like movies, where you actually have edits?
Oh, edits, they started gluing things together pretty early on. They didn't start making stories until, I guess, really around the early 1900s. But, you know, one point I'd like to make about seeing old films, I know a lot of people have never seen a black and white film. I know a lot of people who have never seen a silent film. You have to make adjustments when you're seeing films like that. It's just like reading Dickens or Shakespeare. You have to adapt to their vocabulary, their narrative strategies. And if you do, you can really make a connection to them.
You appeared on our show some years ago on an April Fool's Day as somebody who was a film editor who had found lost footage from Greed.
I know. I'm still living that down.
You asked at the time, why would anybody want this? You can't hear them talk. You were really making fun of that whole sensibility that movies didn't really matter before 1929, before the talkies came in.
For a lot of people growing up today, movies don't matter before 1960, which is why the majority of the titles in this book are represented mostly in the 30s and 40s. But it's great to see films from 1909, 1910. It's great to see what people thought acting was, what they look like, what they're doing. You also learn about a lot of personalities. I know you like Raoul Walsh a lot. He's represented on here with four films. And you can see his progression. He goes from Regeneration in 1916 up to White Heat in 1949, probably his last significant film. You get to learn about him. You get to learn what he was like. I hadn't really realized that he was an actor. I knew he grew up in a privileged Manhattan.
He lost his eye while he was acting, didn't he?
On location. Yeah. He was scouting locations for In Old Arizona and driving in the desert, and a jackrabbit jumped through his windshield and blinded him. And he was going to star in that film, and the person who replaced him won the Best Acting Oscar for that film.
Did seeing these films and in sequence give you a sense of whether the auteur theory really works or not? That the director is the author of the film, because the French felt that that no matter who wrote the script, the director really brought a certain sensibility that tied all of his or her films together.
I think there's an author for each film. I'm not sure if it's the director. Sometimes it's the star. Sometimes it's a producer like Daryl Zanuck, who really controlled his films. But yes, you see, and especially if you're watching chronologically, you see someone like John Ford. He's very definitely an auteur. He's very definitely someone who's in command of what's appearing on the screen. And you can see his work evolving through the years. Ford is someone who just seemed to always want to try and recapture a moment in the past where the world made sense to him. He's different from other directors like Frank Capra, who's trying to make a statement, or Joseph Mankiewicz, who's trying to improve the world. Ford is just, you know, he's trying to capture a moment in time, and he does it so well. It's a lot more moving than a lot of the other directors on the list.
My guest is Daniel Egan, whose book, American Film Legacy, A Guide to the National Film Registry, is published by Continuum. It's a book that lists all 500 of the films. Some of these films, you say, are just seconds long, and others go on for 8 hours or so?
Longer than that, really. The serials are very long. Yes, some of them are only 20 seconds long, so... It was my job, I thought, to put them in context, to show how a short cartoon or a documentary was on equal footing with a big epic film.
A lot of films have disappeared. For example, you mentioned John Ford. He, I think, directed over 100 films. Not all of them have survived.
He made a gazillion films, I think. And most of the silent films are gone. They're gone. And that's the sad fact is that some estimates 80% of silent features have disappeared.
And that's just simply because we didn't respect them, or because they were put on stock that was highly flammable?
A lot of different reasons. I think it was mostly because no one could figure out a way to make money from them anymore, so they abandoned them.
A listener wants to know if you're familiar with the documentary film called Grass, which was made in the 20s.
Yes, and it's on the list. It's Marion C. Cooper and Ernest Schoedsack in Iran.
Marion C. Cooper of King Kong?
The very one and the same. Is that the right phrase? It's the same.
Yeah.
Yes.
That same Marion C. Cooper.
The same one who was imprisoned during after World War I in Russia and escaped on foot, and the same one who crashed flying a plane for Poland and burned his fingers. The same one who introduced the Cinerama, and the same one whose wife is in The Searchers and who produced The Searchers.
Another, a very, very great film.
Excellent film. And, you know, I just, if I have time, I wanted to mention how this, doing, researching this book, brought me into contact with a lot of things that I wouldn't have ordinarily come into contact with. For example, The Searchers, I read the novel that it was based on. I read the novel that Flower Drum Song was based on, Lassie Come Home. I tried to read all of those. And The Searchers novel was really a tremendous book. I was very surprised. And it broadened my appreciation for what the film was.
In seeing some of these films, again, now thinking about them for your book, were you surprised at how well some had held up or how poorly some had held up?
Well, I have my personal taste. There are films I don't want to see again, let's put it that way. There are filmmakers I have had my fill with. What made me very happy was that the films that, by Buster Keaton, for example, or John Ford, the films that were really great back then still hold up very well.
I've heard that James Cameron is now planning to go back and redo all of his films in 3D. And some people wondered whether the people who saw Titanic 30 times when it first came out would even care about seeing it in 3D. But we do see a lot of technological advances over the years as well, don't we? Or do you think that movies are not all that much better today than they were in the past?
Oh, I mean, is painting better today than it was in the past? Is music better today than it was in the past? They were doing 3D experiments that are just beautiful back in 1925. They're wonderful films. They are spectacular.
And they're on the registry?
Not yet. I hope they get on. But all those technological advances, and I think James Cameron will be the first to say it, it doesn't compensate if you don't have a good story, good actors, good performances. Technology is not really going to help you. And you can see there are films on this list made by amateurs, first-time filmmakers, who are very sophisticated films, very entertaining films, and they didn't have the technology, they didn't have the knowledge to do that, and they still turned out great movies.
Well, Hitchcock pulled off all sorts of incredible effects without having computer-generated images. I mean, he has, in one of his films, he has a plane crash into the ocean, and today it would be done, I guess, with computers. And then he had to work out other solutions.
So maybe it's better not to have those devices to lean on. Maybe it's better to have to figure out how to do it in real time and actually endanger everybody's lives.
And endanger everybody's... Well, that is not what happened in that film. Which directors are represented most on the list? Is it somebody like John Ford who just made so many movies?
You know, I put the list together here. John Ford is number one, yes. He's represented by 8 films. Then George Stevens, Frank Capra, Howard Hawks, Alfred Hitchcock, people like that.
So the best directors wind up being most represented. Was there anything that surprised you about the films as you went through all 500? Any themes emerge?
I got this image, actually. It was surprising. I got this image of America as a very cold, hard place. I was surprised at how violent it was and how much murder and death and suicide there was. You find suicide in films like The Crowd in 1925 and even in The Apartment in 1960. Billy Wilder comedy hinges on a suicide attempt. That really surprised me. It surprised me how much filmmakers were willing to question society, social structures, question things like ambition and drive, the very things that we think are hallmarks of our society. And a lot of the filmmakers had deep, serious doubts about that.
And there were concerns that when we showed these films in other countries that people would get the wrong impression about what America was like.
Well, that's why they would pick films like Roman Holiday to show in Russia. And they would pick very carefully what films they would like to see, yes. People complained about that in the United States as well. I Was a Fugitive from a Chain Gang, which is a really chilling, horrifying film. People in America didn't want audiences here to see that either. That got into a lot of trouble.
Did you have an opportunity to speak to any of the directors of the films?
I did. I interviewed a number of them, and they were unfailingly polite. I was very surprised. I thought they would not want to deal with my questions. One example is Ernie Gehr out in Brooklyn, a wonderful filmmaker. I didn't really understand what he was doing, and he had to carefully correct all of my mistakes. And
he's an experimental filmmaker.
Yes, yes. He's a wonderful filmmaker, and he was very patient with all of the mistakes I made. I have to thank him for that.
What kinds of mistakes were you making? You misinterpreting his film?
I didn't know how he was doing it, and that was the important thing about it. Actually, it's not. The film that's on the list is Serene Velocity, and I don't want to give away anything about it. I think it's a film that you just have to go in knowing nothing about, and if you see it, you will never forget it.
Uh-huh. Well, you got some really nice blurbs from people like Leonard Maltin and Francis Ford Coppola, and filmmaker Terry Sanders said that he was surprised that you hadn't written another dry academic pro forma overview of familiar film history. I'm assuming that was your goal from the start, not to do that kind of academic thing.
I'm not an expert. I'm an enthusiast. And I felt my job here was to try and get people reading it to go and see the movies themselves and enjoy themselves, give them the information they needed to appreciate what the films were.
Did you come away with any personal favorites?
Well, there are films that I've always loved that hold up really well here, like the Keaton films and John Ford. I was really impressed with William Wyler's earlier work. Seeing it all in a row, I saw just what he was accomplishing. He was really great. And then there are filmmakers like Len Lai, whom I've always loved. And
who's Len Lai?
Len Lai was born in New Zealand. His animator worked for the BBC. Not the BBC. He worked for the British Film Office before World War II. Again, worked here in the March of Time after World War II. He is a great animator, a really incredibly influential animator. He's represented by Free Radicals in this list, which he made by scratching designs onto black emulsion, 60mm emulsion. It's a 4-minute film. He used saw teeth, needles, just any kind of device to scratch these things, and he actually made abstract wiggles dance in time. It's an amazing performance.
Carla wants to know if there are any science fiction films on the list. I assume since there were so many made in Hollywood, there are a fair number.
Well, yes. There's The Thing from Another World, The Day the Earth Stood Still. There's Star Wars. There are a number of science fiction films.
If you were on the selection committee, what films would you recommend be included in the next 25?
Gee, I would have to put some more Buster Keaton on there, I think. I think he's not represented well enough. And then I think there are filmmakers...
I want to stop with Buster Keaton. Why do you think that is? In his time, Buster Keaton was considered one of the greats. Today, when we think about silent film stars, we're much more likely to think of Chaplin.
Yes. Keaton's actually represented almost as much as Chaplin is. I think they're trying to balance out the registry. They've included a number of other silent comedians as well, Laurel and Hardy, Charlie Chase, Max Davidson. So they're trying to give a broad sampling of what was available. Putting more Keaton on, I guess you could do it, but I guess they have other priorities.
Mm-hmm. And nothing new that hasn't made it?
New films?
Newer.
Well, they have Fargo and Toy Story and films like that, Unforgiven. The list goes up to about 10 years ago.
Daniel Egan's American Film Legacy, A Guide to the National Film Registry, is published by Continuum Press. And he will be introducing the program, The Docs of New York and Selected Shorts, at the National Film Industry with live piano accompaniment on March 22nd. For more information, go to our show page. That will be taking place at the Film Forum. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Leonard.